When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Larnion, and welcome to the Green Chain Podcast for the TIE.ca, where we try to see the forest and the trees. Our first guest is from Canada's first family of environmentalism. 15 years ago, at the age of 12, Severin Kulla Suzuki rocked the United Nations Earth Summit in Rio, stealing the spotlight from global leaders like Al Gore. "In my life," she said, "I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see." Ever since then, she's been doing her part to keep those forests and butterflies alive. She was on the UN Charter Commission. She's in Vanity Fair's Hall of Fame. She's got an undergrad degree from Yale in ecology and evolutionary biology. She's just finishing her master's degree in ethnobotany at the University of Victoria. She's one of the editors and writers of the inspiring new book, Notes from Canada's Young Activists, A Generation Stands Up for Change. And yeah, her dad is Dr. David Suzuki. But Severin's not just recycling her dad's ideas as she tries to redefine activism and environmentalism for a new generation. First off, tell me about the book.
The book. Okay, well,
how did it come about?
I just finally completed our new book, Notes from Canada's Young Activists, A Generation Stands Up for Change. I wanted it to be called A Generation Stands Up for a Change, because I thought that would be, you know, kind of funny, playing off Douglas Copeland's, you know, characterization of Generation X. Anyways, basically, it's a collection of stories of young people who are from across Canada, but we tried to get a very wide variety of people who are basically making things happen in their communities. And the idea came to us. I was doing a fellowship called Action Canada, and I met three other people who were similar to me but working on very different issues. And part of the mandate of Action Canada is very idealistic. It gives a fellowship to about 20 young Canadians each year, and you have to come up with a project that will somehow benefit Canadians in 10 months.
Nice.
So after starting to talk to each other, learning about our different backgrounds, Chris was interested in water treatment, but he was working for an oil company in Alberta. He's of a Métis background. Cynthia McKenzie, she was very much rooted in the NGO world. And Ahmed Casey, who was originally from Iraq, was very much into civic engagement as an immigrant Canadian, was very interested in democratic issues. And what did we have in common? We had in common a passion for making our country something we could be proud of. And we realized just in talking to each other that just the stories of who we were the really inspiring part. That was what was really interesting. It wasn't, you know, what we'd done or our CVs or anything. And we realized that if we collected the stories from the young people across this country who are really making a difference, that would be the most inspirational thing we could think of doing. So finally, 3 years later, not 10 months later, we have Notes from Canada's Young Activists.
Okay. How did you track? I mean, I've checked out the book. It's a really diverse group. Some of the people I recognize from media, some I didn't know anything about. How did you track down this group?
Well, we realized just talking to each other that we knew through people we knew in common, people we'd heard of, there were all kinds of people who were actually, you know, from our peer group, from our age group, who were already really shifting society. And so just amongst the four of us, we came up with a list of well over 60 people. And then gradually, you know, when we're actually coming down to, okay, how are we going to do this, the list got whittled down. We approached people, they recommended other people, and finally we came to 25 people who actually contributed their stories. Okay. But we all know people who could be in this book, and that was kind of the point, is we wanted to highlight people who were amazing, but also we all know people like them. They're in every community. They're in each of us. And we really hope that people reading the book would find some element that they could recognize inside themselves.
In the intro to your book, it talks about your passion about the connections between culture and the ecology. Can you talk a bit about the connections that you see?
Well, that's a big question. I think that we are very connected to our environment, and it's not just in a physical way. I mean, it's obvious when you think in biological terms how connected we are with our environment, just in the simple fact that we eat food. I mean, food is where the external world, your environment, becomes part of your body. And this is something we don't often think about. But besides that, we have all kinds of values and experiences that really shape who we are that come from simply the matrix where we all exist, which is another way of describing our environment. And I think most people don't really think of that when they think of this word, the environment. It tends to be kind of marginalized or compartmentalized as, having to do with, crazy old David Suzuki, or maybe the Kyoto Protocol, or maybe hippies chaining themselves to trees, or something that's very much externalized when, it's simply all that surrounds us. And we're very culturally affected by the culture of environment that we surround ourselves with.
Now, I read some interviews where you don't define yourself, or you don't identify yourself as an environmentalist, and I thought that was fascinating. Can you talk about why?
Well, I just feel like I'm really a concerned citizen. I feel that when I hear even the word environmentalist, I tend to have a certain stereotype that comes up in my mind. And like I just said, you think of the word environment and your mind immediately goes to recycling.
Yeah.
Or, some idea of a natural park or something that's, out there, isn't relevant to your daily life. And I'm very concerned about human welfare. I'm very concerned with my own well-being. And this is why I care about these so-called environmental issues, because they really are social issues. They really are about quality of life. And they're really about all these other issues that, to me, I feel are really what it's about, and not necessarily about, panda bears and whales. But that's not a very good way of describing what I mean, but we just need a more holistic way of looking at the world around us.
Do you have a description you use? Do you have a favorite term?
Am I supposed to call you an activist?
Or,
I know.
Or
well, that's another thing. First, we were a little scared of calling our book, Notes from Canada's Young Activists, because a lot of the people in this book wouldn't necessarily call themselves activists, And I think that word, like environmentalist, can be whatever you define it as. And I really feel like an engaged citizen or an advocate is something that I'm more comfortable with, because I feel like I want to encourage people to speak out and be active in their community, but activist has a lot of baggage connected to it, and I really believe in being positive. So,
okay,
there you go.
Now, you're just about through your master's in ethnobotany at UVic, right?
Right.
Can you explain what ethnobotany is beyond one of the coolest words of all time?
Oh, I'm glad you think so.
It's a great word.
People are like, ethno what? Well, ethnobotany, it's kind of in a field called ethnoecology, which is, it sounds complicated, it's really simple. The ethno is humans and culture, and botany is plants. And I've been working with Kwakwaka'wakw elders, so First Nations elders, learning about their plant resource management and how people used to gather plants.
I don't think I'd ever heard the term ethnobotany before Wade Davis. I don't think I was familiar with it at all.
It's a relatively new field. I mean, kind of started at the beginning of the last century or early decades of the last century. But yeah, it's one of those small disciplines that is growing. And for me, I think it's a field that's absolutely essential as we're starting to talk more and more about sustainable resource management. It strikes me as crazy that if we're trying to figure out how to live and sustain and produce in the 21st century in a sustainable way, how could we not at least have an understanding or ask how people who lived in the same place for thousands of years and how they did it, how they lived sustainably, how they sustained, tens of thousands of people in different areas of the province. We've got to know how they did it.
Well, I thought it was fascinating that you ended up, that in your essay, you dealt with historic aquaculture. I mean, it just never would have occurred to me. I mean, I guess I should get you to explain what you wrote about, but
how they managed the clams, how Rainier Beach.
Absolutely. It's an amazing story. And when I found out about it almost 3 years ago, I was absolutely blown away. And I think that was a real turning point for me. I was sitting in class, and I was in Nancy Turner's class, and she'd invited these two Kwakwaka'wakw people to speak to us about clam gardens. And they were Kim Raquel McClutasy and Chief Adam Dick, and they were describing these traditional aquaculture clam gardens, essentially. And there are these terraces that people used to build up and down the coast, and you can still see them. They're very distinct. They're around beaches that have flat sandy beaches and where you find a lot of clams. And actually, these were man-made. These were made by people for who knows how many thousands of years, and they rolled rocks down to the zero tide level, which aquaculturists are discovering is the optimal level for clams, and they were actually creating more habitat so that people could eat more clams. And actually, you go back in the midden, in the middens, and apparently at about 2,000 years ago, the shells shift from being mostly oysters and mostly mussels. They suddenly shift to being mostly clams, and they think that maybe that's about when the technology for clam gardens arose, so that it could be a major food source to sustain the many people that lived in that area between Vancouver Island and the mainland.
Now, did you discover anything about forestry that's applicable now?
Forestry. Well, one of the main concepts that I've been learning about is, as Nancy Turner calls it, is this attitude or an ethos of keeping it living. She calls it keeping it living, and it comes from her learnings from the many different elders she was talking to, and specifically Kwakwaka'wakw teaching this phrase of keeping it living. And basically, the concept is it's pretty basic when you really think about it. It's harvesting plants, harvesting resources in a way that keeps that resource alive, that keeps that population abundant. And so you can see this ethic when you look at CMTs, culturally modified trees, and you see these giant trees that have been alive for, you know, sometimes 1,000 years, and they have a big plank cut out of them, but they're still alive. And so that would be, you know, that would have been harvested in the ethic of keeping it living, because things were harvested in a way that didn't fundamentally damage the resource base. To us, this is an amazing concept, to us living in the 21st century, coming from a Western training, and that's because basically all our fundamental principles of resource management, of forestry, are just take as much as you can. And we're basically, you know, we're taking too much from our capital, and that's why, you know, what we used to think of as being a renewable resource, like trees, now it's becoming not such a renewable resource. So that is a pretty good ethic that we should learn from.
Now, reading some of the stories about you, it talks about you working to protect forests in BC, in Southeast Asia, in the Amazon. But it wasn't specific about what your involvement was, what you were doing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I basically got involved in some of those projects abroad through my family work. My family has been very involved in issues in the Caiapó, which is in Brazil, and working all over the country just with different indigenous groups and learning about what those issues were. So there was a lot of family involvement and support and protests. And when I was very young, I went down to the Amazon, and it was a pretty life-changing experience for me, just seeing the kinds of impact that deforestation due to burning in the Amazon is having, you know, not only for the Caiapó people, but for the poverty-stricken Brazilians who are actually inflicting this, you know. That's totally unsustainable for everybody. Also, in Sarawak, when I was very young, I started getting involved very young, and I had lots of influence.
You're kind of famous for getting involved.
Yeah, exactly. One of my first projects was fundraising for the Penan people of Sarawak to buy them a water filter, because the forestry that was going on at the time in the 90s was polluting the water that a Penan group of people had to drink. So me and my friends decided we wanted to fundraise and buy a water filter for them, which we were able to actually present to some traveling Penan people. So that kind of involvement is kind of the level that I've been involved at.
Now, what did you just... You were saying you just saw some fascinating things in Tasmania regarding how they're handling their forests.
Yeah, very interesting. I was recently in Tasmania, and I was speaking at a conference on biodiversity, and while I was in Launceston, which is one of the main cities, I learned about the current issue, which was the building of a pulp mill, and the town was just at the point of deciding whether or not they wanted a pulp mill. And right now, pretty much the biggest industry in Tasmania is the export of wood chips. And there's actually a lot of old growth logging that's going on to make wood chips that get shipped abroad and then made into paper. And so one of the reasons for building a pulp mill is, well, you know, we need to have value added to our resources. I mean, it's crazy if they're just shipping over the wood chips and then they're buying back the paper. And so that was one of the arguments. And it became this very this very big debate in the community. The community was very divided. But at the same time, there was an amazing amount of really healthy debate. I mean, there were civic forums. There was a lot of attention in the media to the pros, the cons. There also was a lot of attention to a democratic issue that was also happening at the same time. There, so we had the one issue of just basically a decision, pulp mill or no pulp mill. And then there was also another democratic issue where a major company that is the major forestry company actually in all of Australia was putting a lot of pressure on people to support the building of the pulp mill and not necessarily pushing through the plans to make sure that the pulp mill was ecologically, you know, the best of the best. So there was all kinds of weird intimidation things happening and all kinds of silencing of, you know, people's voices. And so there was that issue at the same time, and it just made for a very interesting dynamic. And I couldn't really say whether they should or should not have a pulp mill, but all I could do was talk about our experiences here in BC and, you know, really present or ask them to really do their homework and ask other cities that have pulp mills, what have been the ramifications of that to their communities?
Well, looking at BC, what did you say? What would you warn them about?
Well, one thing is, a big thing is health issues. And I'm not going to name any areas specifically, but, you know, the health consequences of having a pulp mill in your town are quite major. And people have to look at cancer rates. They have to look at asthma rates. Air pollution is already a problem in the Tamar region in Tasmania, so they've got to think about that. And really look at the stats for what the health effects are or what health problems are, because they might not necessarily be correlated in, you know, by scientists necessarily, but you might just happen to have a very high cancer rate in a small town that has a very large pulp mill. And another thing that they really got to realize is also pollution of shellfish, pollution of the marine environment around that pulp mill. And there's many places, well, I don't really know anywhere that has a pulp mill where people are still gathering clams and harvesting the food right around where that pulp mill is. I mean, it's kind of just accepted that, oh, well, you don't gather food anywhere near where that pulp mill is. So, I mean, that has an economic cost. And those kinds of things, well, you know, the community really has to be aware of, and those are the kinds of things that they need to think about when they're making decisions. And finally, I think, you know, we really have to fundamentally think about the long term, and we're not doing that right now. We're really not doing that, and it's something I bring up a lot. It's been a big part of my role as a young person speaking out, is asking people when they make these decisions whether or not to have a pulp mill, really think about their children. People love their children. And if that's true, then they've got to make decisions for the future of their kids. And I think that totally puts a different spin on the kinds of questions that people should ask when they're making those kinds of decisions.
I lived in Williams Lake for a year, and I remember being surprised at how many car washes there were until I found out about fly ash and discovered that there were sort of drifts of snow every once in a while from the wood waste burners.
Or
what looked like snow. It was just amazing. So, one of the things that I read about on one of your websites that I found fascinating was your recognition of responsibility. Can you explain what that is and how that came up?
Well, the recognition of responsibility came about just at the end of my university experience. I went to school in the States, and I'd made lots of American friends, to my surprise. They're not all like George Bush. And it was also... Our graduation was also right at on the eve of the Johannesburg Earth Summit, which was the 10-year anniversary of the United Nations Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. And this 10-year anniversary got a lot of attention. They were going to have another summit. And George Bush decided not to go. And my American friends were pretty upset about this. They really were concerned about how the world would perceive America. Of course, this is post September 11th, and already there was a lot of, there was a lot of polarization between America and the rest of the world on how they reacted to that. And now here, George Bush wasn't going to go to the Johannesburg Earth Summit and participate in this very important work. And so they wanted to send a message to the conference, the people, the media at the conference, that not all Americans are like George Bush, and that many Americans are willing to make a commitment and take responsibility for their actions. And so we came up with a pledge. It's a one-page statement. It's called a recognition of responsibility, and it's a pledge saying, today I take responsibility for my lifestyle. I acknowledge that I live in one of the most consuming countries in the world, and my per capita, my use of resources and the waste that I produce is much higher than the global average. And today I'm going to try to take responsibility for that. And it lists a whole bunch of ways that we can start dealing with our own ecological footprint. And the idea was that if we had a roster of people who signed up for this, people wouldn't feel so alone. They wouldn't feel like, well, if I take my bike to work, it's not going to make a difference. They would know that, no, there's, 5,000 other people who are also pledging to make this effort, and so that the effect is actually magnified. So that was really the idea and how it came to be.
Now, your dad turned me off bottled water, except for the bubbly kind, and I heard an interview with you on CBC Radio talking about, recycle your, get a Starbucks mug that you can just bring back every time. What are some of the small things that people can do to try and make the environment better?
Well, I think at this point of saturation of environmental information, I think we know what we have to do. And it's kind of like one of those things that, it's like you want to lose weight and you're looking for the real, this magic silver bullet or something, this fad diet or some pill that you can pop. And really deep down, you know that if you don't eat junk and if you exercise, that's, really the only way that you're going to, be healthy. And I feel like it's the same way with the environment. And it's about habits. And that's why it's so difficult. I had a little bit of an epiphany when I watched Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And it wasn't necessarily because of the content. I thought the movie was great. But right at the end, when you're all fired up and you're going to stand up and join the army to fight climate change, these little suggestions come onto the screen when the credits are rolling. And they're so small. They're like, change a light bulb, carpool, ride your bike, calculate your emissions, buy carbon credits. They're all these little thing. And I kind of was standing by my seat and I thought, come on, I want to know what the solution is. I want to know, where to sign up or where to join. And I was really disappointed. I thought, come on, Al Gore, you can do better than this. And then it suddenly dawned on me, no, that those are the solutions. That is how we change the world. That is how we are currently dealing with climate change, because it was all our little decisions that we didn't even think about that have created this giant global problem. And it's going to be a distinct shifting of those little habits that is going to actually bring us down to some kind of moderate or moderated level of greenhouse gas emissions. And it's not glamorous and it's not sexy, but I think that they're getting more commonplace, and we know what they are. And they're things like reduce your waste and reduce your energy consumption. And there's tons of places you can find out how to do that. One thing that actually is really interesting is calculating your ecological footprint, because that is really, you know, it connects you directly to the issues that I've been talking about.
Okay. Your essay mentions fighting citizenism. How do you fight it? How do you stay optimistic? Because I sat at a panel, co-green panel, that actually your dad was speaking at Banff. It was your dad and Daryl Hannah and a couple of other speakers. And one of the people stood up and said, how do you not just burst into tears knowing what you know? Now, you're more wired into environmental issues than almost anyone else. How do you fight the cynicism? How do you stay optimistic?
Well, it's tough sometimes. It's tough. After I came back from Australia a few weeks ago, I was pretty upset. It wasn't just, I mean, the Tamar issue, the pulp mill issue is not the big thing, but I also learned more about the fact that we are now living through the sixth mass extinction that the planet has ever seen, and it's caused by us. Every year, 2,700 species go extinct, and that's a really moderate estimate. So when you actually think about our destruction, you actually kind of get plugged in and you think about climate change and how much pain it's already causing humanity. It can get really depressing. But you can't spend time there, because there are also equally so many amazing things happening right now. And this is one of the big reasons or the big goals that we had with this book, Notes from Canada's Young Activist, is showing the opportunity in this time. And I've met a couple of people lately who have a very interesting attitude. They say, how lucky are we? How exciting is this time? How lucky are we to be alive when the forces of good and evil are just so clear, when we're undergoing such a massive time of shift, and where our actions really, really matter, for good or for bad. This is a really unique period in history, and it's a time when an individual, I think, can have more impact than ever before in our human history, because of the internet, because of communication, because of how easily we can travel. And we really, especially in the first world, we really have to realize how empowered we can be, how much we actually matter. And that goes, you know, you can look at it in a negative light and say, wow, you know, my ecological footprint is like 11 times that of a Bengali in India. Or you can look at it and say, well, because my actions really matter and my footprint is big, I can make that footprint do something positive for the world. And that's the attitude that I choose to take, because it's far more exciting. It's far more sustainable for me emotionally. And I want to be part of a beautiful movement. I don't want to be part of a doom and gloom, depressing kind of movement. But I think this is an exciting time, and we need warriors.
Excellent. I got a couple of questions I want to ask everybody who I'm interviewing for this. How do you feel about trees?
Trees. That's a good question. Well, I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who didn't feel some kinship for trees. I'm always amazed by how sheltering trees are. If you go from standing on pavement or standing in a clearing to standing in a stand of trees, I mean, there's such a marked difference. You're either really hot in the sun of a clearing, and then you step into shade and it's just so relieving, or you're really cold and you're out in the open, and then you step into a grove of trees and you're suddenly sheltered. And every time I experience that, I think about how obvious it is that, you know, we're cutting down all the trees on the planet, and of course we're going to have some localized climate change right there, because we're totally shifting these trees, which are so important for regulating regulating the atmosphere. So I think that they're this amazing force, and I love trees, but I also think that, you know, they're going to outlast us. So I don't necessarily feel sorry for the trees. I feel more hoping that more people had respect for them.
If somebody put you in charge of the BC forests tomorrow, what would you do?
Well, that's a serious question. I need a week to think about that one. One thing that has really confused me is why environmentalists and loggers weren't on the same team. I mean, to me, someone who wants to have a livelihood harvesting wood has to be involved in their sustainability. And I've never really understood that. I have a lot of ideas of now why, and I think that it's really also a big task for the environmental movement, the conservation movement, to start shifting their ideas of what is, you know, quote unquote natural and how to use forests, because we all need paper, we all need to use the forests, but we need a vision that can actually maintain these forests, not only for their beauty and biodiversity, but also for their productivity and for the resources that we need. And I just see that goal of serving both people who want to have parks and people who want to have jobs. And it seems to me crazy that, you know, no loggers who are currently working in the industry today, none of them are encouraging their sons to join their profession. And that's because they know that it's on its way out. So we just gotta really start thinking about how those two paradigms really can come together, because I think they're absolutely joined. That totally avoided your question, but I can't answer it in 5 minutes.
That was a terrific answer. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Severin Kulla Suzuki. Her book, Notes from Canada's Young Activists, A Generation Stands Up for Change, is published by Greystone Books, a division of Douglas & McIntyre. Coming up on future Green Chain podcasts, one of the most respected voices of BC forest workers, Wade Fisher, and John Valiant, author of the Governor General's Award winner, The Golden Spruce, a true story of myth, madness, and greed. Thanks for checking out the Green Chain podcast, and be sure to visit thegreenchain.com. For the Tyee.ca, I'm Mark Larignan.